are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 28th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. You're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Stoller, fellow at the Open Market Institute, author of Goliath. The 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. Also on the program today, despite Donald Trump, military kills the ISIS leader al-Baghdadi. Meanwhile, a Bolton deputy slated to testify today instead seeks a court ruling, which is either a slow walk tactic, or it could be big problems for other members of the Trump administration. Meanwhile, the EU agrees to another Brexit extension, a new English election in the offing, just a rolling cluster of stuff. 200,000 people evacuate in California, fleeing wildfires. As people debate what to do with PG&E, Pacific Gas and Energy Company. Those Black Jewel coal miners in Kentucky, they have won their fight for back pay after almost 2 months of literally putting their bodies in front of trains with coals. Speaking of which, massive protests in Chile forced the president to replace his entire cabinet, unlikely to be enough. 1 million of the 18 million Chileans hit the streets, I think this weekend. 7-8% of the entire country. The equivalent of that would be 25 million people in one place in this country. Meanwhile, California Congresswoman Katie Hill to resign in the wake of a revenge porn play by ex-husband. Shia Tlaib endorses Bernie Sanders. Exxon sued by the Massachusetts AG for hiding knowledge of climate change from consumers and investors. And rest in peace, John Conyers, former congressman, ousted because of sexual harassment claims, dead at age 90. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I am back from Las Vegas. My voice is almost recovered. I tend to indulge a little bit too much while I'm there, and so that impacts my ability to speak.
Let's meet up with the guys from the other tour table and go tear it up.
It's exactly right. It's exactly right.
The guys with the asbestos case have the hookup. Let's go.
It honestly is like it is sort of like crazy the conversations I'll have at like 1 a.m. about going after this hotel chain regarding trafficking, or, you know, sort of like the horrible stuff that this attorney found in discovery about, you know, X, Y, or Z drug, or it is pretty stunning. You just drink copious amounts of alcohol and then talk about the worst human beings in the world. But it's fun to do a couple of times a year for me. I hope you enjoyed those interviews that we had this this go round. Sometimes you just don't know what you're going to get down there, but I thought those interviews were quite interesting. Some house cleaning. We are several hundred people away from 10,000 followers on Instagram. If you have an Instagram account, by all means, you should be following us and spreading it around to your friends, because the stuff that our artificial intelligence bot is posting up there is fantastic. So check it out. I think the latest thing is a Andrew Yang karaoke that you really need to see to believe. Also, our apps are up. We're going to be shooting a video in the next couple of days on how to use it, but it's quite simple. Both iOS and Android, you can get it at majorityapp.com or just get it on wherever you get your apps. Not only can you log in as a member, not only can you search the archives, not only do you get links for stuff and listen live or watch the YouTube or IM the show or call the show, all within the app. You also get the AM Quickie. And if you have not signed up for the AM Quickie, we need your help. Go do it. Try it out. People seem to love the show. It has actually 94 reviews on iTunes at this point, and all the reviews help because now iTunes is back up. And so, you know, getting reviews for it is really going to make a big difference. Has 94 reviews on iTunes. Three of them are 4-star and 91 are 5-star. So head over there and review the AM Quickie and check it out. It just gives you the headlines you need every morning, less than 5 minutes. And gives you a slight preview of what we're going to be talking about on the show. So check that out. And lastly, I just want to say thank you to Ronald Reagan, who sent me a Thanos collector's item action figure. I don't know if it's a collection item. But he just wrote, "Wow, Sam, this is basically you. Makes you effing think." And there it is. Thanos.
Reagan!
All right, let's get into this. We're going to be starting off today's program with something that is probably largely irrelevant in the great scheme of things, although it does give you a certain amount of hope. Later in the fun half, we will discuss how some people are reacting to it and why it's ridiculous, their reaction. But as you know, or may not know, the World Series is now we're on game... six now, right? And Houston Astros and Washington Nationals. Astros are up now 4-2. And because the game was played in Washington, D.C., and my understanding is that the owners of the Nationals were sort of hoping that the president wouldn't ask to sit with them, which I can understand. And as is customary, presence of the president of the United States is announced to everyone in the ball field. And, well, people weren't so psyched to see him. Here it is. And they have a picture of some Marines on the big Jumbotron. Everybody's cheering. They're Marines, of course. Military. That's what sporting events are all about. And there's the president of the United States. Ooh. And then they cut back to the Marines just for the juxtaposition. Here's Donald Trump's perspective on it. As he's getting booed, he is, it's a little hurtful to him. So if you have problems seeing someone's feelings get hurt, you might want to look away from Donald Trump's expression.
It's the World Series. The president, the first lady of the United States, Donald J. Trump, and Melania Trump.
Clapping. There's booing, and then he just waves quickly, and then they're booing at me. They're booing at me. They're booing at me. They're booing at me. He's so mad. And I got to say, it's like one of those things that's like where like he looks like a freshman in high school who's walking down the hallway and he sees somebody wave and you're like, hey, and you realize they're not waving at you and you just sort of like take your hand and just go, you know, like that.
Oh, hey, that's AJ. He's really cool. Hey, what's up? Oh, I wasn't waving.
Oh my God, I can't believe the seniors are waving.
I don't even know them anyways. They're stupid.
I hate all of those people.
I hate Washington, D.C. I hate everybody.
And then, sadly, and we will talk about this more in our analysis later in the program of just what has happened to this country. But the audience at the Washington Nationals World Series game came up with a plan in which to salute their president. And here is what they came up with.
Yeah. Lock him up. Finally.
Yep.
I wonder if
notice like Democrats follow the lead of your people. It starts on the streets. Don't be like, yeah, don't do that.
I wonder if the higher up you are in the stadium, the more likely you are to chant lock him up, because that's the upper deck right there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting theory. But we will get to more of the reaction to that, which is actually almost as ridiculous as just, I mean, it's as ridiculous as anything I've seen, but we will check that out later. Hey, folks, Babbel will get you speaking a new language quickly and with confidence. You can choose from 14 different languages: Spanish, French, Italian, Portuguese, Russian. There was a whole mess of them. Speak your new language within weeks. Babbel's teaching method and speech recognition technology has been proven effective across multiple studies. Babbel's lessons, they're not created by algorithms. They're not created by artificial intelligence. They're created by 100 language experts. Those are real human beings, people. And they are convenient. They're engaging. They last 10 to 15 minutes, so you don't get overwhelmed. You learn through interactive dialogues so you can perfect the way that your accent and your pronunciation. It's available as an app on your phone, your iPad, your tablet, I don't know, maybe your watch probably, or online. Progress syncs across all the devices. We are super psyched to get the Majority Report Babbel Challenge going. I wonder if we should actually talk to them about that. I don't know if they know that we're doing that. But Jamie's sick today, so we couldn't get it. We couldn't launch it. We got to launch it in the next couple of days. We're all going to get babbled, as it were, and speak Spanish. I'll take my kids on a trip. We'll take them down to Mexico or something and actually show them. My daughter's doing quite well in Italian. I'm going to get her maybe on this and see if that helps her. Because you listen to this show, Babbel has a very special offer for you. Go to babbel.com, select the language of your choice. Once you try it for free and you're ready to sign up, select the three-month option, and Babbel will give you an additional 3 months for free with the promo code MAJORITY. That's 6 months for the cost of three with promo code MAJORITY. Go to Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L, B-A-B-B-E-L.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY. You get that extra 3 months. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. As you know, I am constantly seeking a way of both having convenience and to stay fit. I think I've been doing a fairly decent job. I have been trying.
In a certain sense.
Kettlebell. Yeah. Are you aware of this?
I'm aware. This is the easiest way to eat healthy imaginable.
Exactly. They deliver it right to your door. I can't even mention this without thinking about that shepherd's pie with sweet potato mash or whatever they call that. It's delicious. But that's the hardest part for me anyways, is how to eat healthily, how much to eat. I have no portion control. I have no idea, honestly.
They got you hooked up on that.
Well, the thing is, exactly. And I'm finding not only do I love the food, but I'm learning how to proportion, like how much I should be eating. I just don't have, like I can go all day without eating, And then I can eat everything in sight. That's not a great way to eat, but Kettlebell offers the nutrition you need without any of the hassle. Their goal is to help you achieve yours. They got meal plans that are tailored to your needs. You can sign up for a plan or order a la carte. There's no long-term contracts required. Meals get delivered to your door twice a week. Optimal freshness. You don't need to worry about sourcing ingredients or fretting over the macros. You just heat, serve, and get the food you need for real sustainable change. They have like multiple different programs. You can get vegetarian. You can go keto, which has like low carb or at least low like starchy carb. Whole 30 and paleo options available. I may try out the paleo.
Check it out.
They got stuff like they had the wild salmon cakes, which are fantastic. I had pulled pork with roasted carrots over rice. I tried like one from the keto, one from the regular. I can't remember where the wild salmon cakes were from, but it was all delicious. And the portion size is super helpful because it gives me a sense of like, this is how much a normal human being eats. There's something I do have some type of brain problem. Feed the champion in you with Kettlebell Kitchen. Go to kettlebellkitchen.com. Kettlebellkitchen.com. Enter the code MAJORITY for $25 off your first two orders. That's if you're a new customer. That's $25 off of each of your first two orders at kettlebellkitchen.com. Code is MAJORITY. And, oh, we got a couple more here. Folks, I'm on the road. It used to be when I went on the road, my dental hygiene would go out the window because I had to bring my my non-electric toothbrush because I'm not going to take one of those huge bulky things with the charger and that. It's just not going to happen. And if you get the old-timey portable ones, those things like the size of a small chainsaw. What is it that makes a better toothbrush? If you ask your dentist, they will tell you, because I have. It's less about the brush. It's more about how you use it. Building a habit. And that is what Quip is. That's what I love the most about Quip. It has like the sensitive vibrations, has a built-in timer. The timer tells you you got to do it for 2 minutes. Sometimes I'll go four. But the point is that it and then it gives you like a pulse every 30 seconds to tell you when to switch. They send you a new brush head every 3 months, has clean new bristles right on schedule. The beauty for me is the design of the brush. It is basically the size of a regular toothbrush. It's beautiful looking, it's stylish, but it's super convenient. And the bottom line is, it doesn't matter what brush you have. If you do not use it and use it properly, it's useless. Quip makes brushing something you want to do twice a day, at least. And the bottom line is, Quip is how you maintain and develop, or I should say develop and maintain a good brushing habit. Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. This is a simple way to get to support the show and start brushing better. Be like my sister. Get the Quip as a gift. Well, I guess I got her for a gift. Have your dentist compliment you. It's pretty crazy. Getquip.com/majority for your first refill free. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Stoller about his new book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy.
I saw the colossal landscape.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program fellow at the Open Markets Institute and author of Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy, Matt Stoller. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's start. And basically, the overview of this is the sort of, the sad tale of how the Democratic Party in particular, I mean, brought more broadly our society, lost sight of some very important principles that made our system work. Let's start just with the general problem that we're facing now. And then I want to go back and follow Wright Patman, who is essentially the the protagonist of your story, who's basically almost in some ways acts as like a narrator, and maybe that's a guide, if you will, through that history. But just let's start with just sort of the problem as you see it.
Yeah, like spirit animal, maybe not, I think might be a good for Patman. So first of all, I thanks for having me. I think, I started writing this book because I was a staffer during the financial crisis, and I'm a Democrat. And I was like, why did we screw everything up so badly, right? Why did we allow a foreclosure crisis? Why did we bail out the banks and enable Wall Street executives to get bonuses instead of jail time? What did we do wrong? And because I saw what the Obama administration did. I saw what people in Congress did. And it was not corrupt. It was not like they were getting bribed for what they were doing. And I was like, what happened? Why did we just systematically promote injustice? And so I looked back over the last century. This kind of led me on a long research project, which ended up in this book. And what I figured out is that there used to be this whole tradition of attacking and fighting concentrated power. And that's a tradition that has largely been hidden, was at least hidden from me, but it was embedded in these kind of rural populist politicians, and Wright Patman is one of them, from Texarkana, who opposed big banks, they opposed monopolies, and they opposed them for political reasons. They thought that they were autocrats, that they were sort of the analogs to fascists in Europe, and they won in the first half of the century. And then in the second half of the century, although really kind of starting more in the 1970s, we allowed our robber barons to return. And you spin that forward 40 years, and today you have, not just the financial crisis caused by too big to fail banks, but also monopolies in every sector of our economy, everything from search and social, which are big markets in cable and airlines, to things like peanut butter or bank management software or syringes, munitions and missiles, just kind of everywhere. Monopolization is a systemic feature of the American economy. And monopolies, what they do, this is the physical manifestation of inequality, right? They increase wage inequality, wealth inequality, regional inequality. They reduce business innovation. They reduce productivity. They're bad for workers. They corrupt our society and our politics, so you can't deal with problems like climate change. It was a philosophical change in the 1970s that led us to think, to transform ourselves from citizens to consumers, and led us to think, oh, well, if we just allow the concentration of capital, that will be more efficient. And that was the philosophy in 2008 that Obama and company and the Democrats in general kind of took with them in trying to address a political crisis. They just thought, well, we learned to concentrate power and wealth to in the hands of economists and technocratic experts to fix problems. So, wow, we have a really big problem now, this huge crisis. So what we really need to do is concentrate wealth and power further to fix that problem. And I know it sounds kind of counterintuitive, but that was the philosophy. Those were the lessons that people learned in the 1970s. And to really understand that, you have to get back to the fights over the New Deal, fights over corporate power, and then how those fights manifested in the 1970s and then and 80s, 90s, and 2000s.
All right. Well, let's do that. And it goes back. It goes back 100 years or so. Let's take us from the sort of the nascent era of anti-monopolism, and where did that sentiment? I mean, to a certain extent, that sentiment was at the founding of the country. No, I mean, on some level, or was that not the case?
No, it was. You know, the Boston Tea Party was not just a revolt against taxes. It was, in fact, a revolt because what the Boston Tea, the East India Company was trying to do is they were trying to ship in cheap tea with tax concessions. So, in fact, the Boston Tea Party was a rebellion against lower taxes because those lower taxes were enabling the East India Company to monopolize the tea trade, essentially to drive out of business all of the middlemen, merchants in the colonies, people like John Hancock. It was like a colonial Walmart. That's what the East India Company was. And the Boston Tea Party and then the tea boycotts were opposition to monopolization. They weren't really opposition to the levying of taxes. They were opposition to the use of the tax system to structure markets in a way that would take power from the colonists and move that power to a monopoly corporation headquartered far away in England.
On some level, the analog, the modern day analog, would have been Amazon not having to pay sales tax for years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know what you see is there were a lot of fears at the time in the 1770s. You know, the East India Company had just they were allowed to occupy territory, so they had just induced a famine in the Bengal province in India. About 1 million people died. And in the kind of North American colonies of the British Empire, Bengal was part of the British Empire, they were worried that, you know, the East India Company could do the same thing here if they were able to monopolize the necessities of life. So there was a national security element to it. But it's always about political power. And today you see the same fight with Amazon, Facebook, and Google, who are a governing. They are private governments. That is what a monopoly is. They are governing our information in our society, and in many ways they are governing our politics. And we have not seen anything like them maybe ever, but maybe since the East India Company, maybe since the robber barons in the late 19th century. It's always hard to draw specific analogies, but this is a political problem. And my book doesn't start with the East India Company. I thought about starting it there, but you know, you kind of, it's always hard to figure out where to start a history book. But, you know, I started in 1910 with Teddy Roosevelt giving a speech at Osawatomie, Kansas. It was 100 years later, Obama actually gave a speech at Osawatomie, Kansas to honor that speech. It was known as the New Nationalism speech. And it's because the election of 1912 was the election when we determined what corporate America would look like. So corporate America really got its start in rough, like 1894, 95, when J.P. Morgan engineered a giant merger wave and created companies like General Electric, International Harvester, U.S. Steel. These were giant roll-ups of the technologically advanced organizations of the day. And by 1910, there was sort of this crisis because you had, you know, massive train accidents, you had huge inequality, you had corruption. It was pretty similar to today. And there had been attempts to deal with it, but the election of 1912 was when you saw a real battle over corporate power. And there was Teddy Roosevelt, who's, you know, he's thought of today as a great trust buster, but in fact he didn't like the antitrust laws. He was more he wanted to actually have monopolies running the country. He just wanted the state to run them. It's almost a kind of proto fascist view, although fascism hadn't been created yet. So. But it was just kind of, how do we contain industrial power? His view was, well, I'll run it. I'll run it out of the White House. And then you had William Howard Taft, who basically didn't want to do much about the monopolies. He just kind of wanted to let private masters run things. And Teddy Roosevelt wanted public masters to run things, a.k.a. Teddy Roosevelt. And then you had Eugene Debs, who in many ways agreed with Teddy Roosevelt, although he wanted to nationalize these monopolies. And then you had Woodrow Wilson, who was advised by Louis Brandeis. And he ran on something called the New Freedom, and he ended up winning. And Brandeis's view was, we need we don't want public masters or private masters. We want no masters. We want to break up these companies, not so that there are no economies of scale, but break them up so that you have a competitive marketplace and then regulate business practices so that the markets stay open and competitive. And so that competition leads to things that we think are socially beneficial, as opposed to, competing based on fraud or harmful activities.
So,
okay. And that was sort of the fight.
Okay.
Right?
So, and we've just sort of laid out the different, I guess, responses that one could have. I mean, for the most part, at least those who want to tackle, these monopolies. So just in terms of Roosevelt and Debs, in terms of their different perspective on this, Debs' perspective, the idea is, right, we're going to democratize the means of production, in that the state is a reflection of all the people, I guess, right?
Debs was a Marxist. I mean, Debs right. wanted to nationalize the means of production, and he also believed, like Roosevelt, that
Matt,
natural.
Hold on, Matt. Are you walking away from your phone?
No.
Okay, there
no,
you go.
Sorry about that.
So he wanted to, he was a Marxist, he wanted to nationalize the means of production. How is that different from what Roosevelt wanted to do? Like, where is the difference there, and what in terms of sort of the philosophical difference?
It wasn't really that different. I mean, that's the thing, is that Roosevelt had a kind of, Roosevelt was probably kind of had a power sharing arrangement with the J.P. Morgans of the day, whereas Debs, I suspect, wanted to just displace them entirely. But philosophically, they weren't that different. In fact, Debs kind of accused Teddy Roosevelt of stealing his platform.
Okay, fair enough. So there, it's a difference, you're saying, in degree as opposed to kind.
Yeah, and I mean, Roosevelt was, I mean, they were just different. They were different characters, and Roosevelt was much more into warfare, whereas Debs had a kind of international solidarity framework. But in general, the underlying philosophy was basically the same.
Okay, and so those are the ways that one would address this, and Brandeis's version wins out, which is this idea that no one's going to have a concentration of power.
That's right. We're going to contain industrial power through what he called industrial democracy, right? And just to give you a sense for why, I know it seems crazy to say Eugene Debs and Teddy Roosevelt were basically the same, but think about it. This debate continued into the 1920s and 30s. And what you saw in the 1930s was you basically saw New Dealers, who were the ideological descendants of Brandeis and Wilson. They looked at Europe and they said, well, fascism in Germany or communism in the Soviet Union, these are both totalitarian systems, right? So they saw them as basically equivalent, one of which was the state taking over the government, and the other one was the government taking over the state.
And where would, and maybe we're leaping ahead a little bit, but let's have it in this context, because we could have this a similar argument, I guess, or a conversation about in terms of Bernie and Warren on some level, and some people are certainly having that. Where would the idea of worker owned workers owning the means of production largely? I mean, where would that fit within that, or is that largely a just a different way of a, or is that something that can coexist and really doesn't have any implications necessarily for antitrust?
Well, so Brandeis was a big fan of worker co-ops. It's really just about, it's more about centralization versus decentralization than the specific ownership models. So Debs wanted federal government to own, most of the means of production. He wasn't totally clear about everything that he wanted, but that was sort of the gist of it. Whereas Brandeis, and I guess later Keynes, and New Dealers were interested in workers having ownership. Co-ops were always a big part of that you know, of that framework, credit unions, associations, things that allowed people to, you know, essentially it was a sort of form of producerism. And producerism says that the people that do the work, that produce the goods or services, should be the ones to benefit from that versus the middlemen, whether those are financiers or whether those are kind of corrupt public servants. And so it was really, the real question was, do you want to centralize production, or do you not want to, or do you want to decentralize production? And Debs and Roosevelt believed that, you know, monopolies are natural, that, you know, it's just a centralization is just the way of the world, very similar to the neoliberal framework. And Brandeis did not think that. Wilson did not think that. And they believed that there was political agency in how we could structure our corporations. They were in favor of co-ops. Taft was not really. I don't think he was a huge fan of co-ops. But the actual ability to own the means of production was not. I mean, that was really the question, was really about whether that would be done centrally or whether you would have decentralized kind of agglomerations of capital competing in markets.
Okay. And I think that's just important for people to understand, because there's almost, it's like a slightly different plane of an argument, right? Where we're looking at just like a slightly different, because, and when we talk about producerism, that takes us up to Patman. But explain how producerism is different in terms of its conceit of a Marxist perspective on what happens with, you know, relationship between labor and capital.
Yeah, so producerism, you go back to, you know, Thomas Jefferson or Thomas Paine, you know, the yeoman farmer model, whatever, he who shall not work shall not eat, which you can go back to even earlier, British, the levelers in the 1600s, you know, just this idea that if you are somebody who produces, you're a worker, you're an engineer, you're a businessman, a businesswoman, you should gain the fruits of that labor. And if you are a middleman or financier, then you should not gain the fruits of other people's labor. Right. That was that's the basic idea. And the vision there is structure markets and structure corporations and structure how human society to enable that, and decentralize ownership of property to enable that. And I think the Marxist perspective, and I'm there are lots of different ways to talk about Marx. So I'm sure there's a bunch of Marxist perspectives which would say, oh, well, we totally agree with that, what I just said about Brandeis. But from my understanding, and sort of from what the Debs and kind of the communist, the pre-Soviet communists thought, is their view was, look, property itself is the problem. Private property itself is the problem. Therefore, what you really should do is just get rid of private property and have everything done communally and collectively through, you know, the centralized state government. And you know, that's just a different vision. I mean, you see that today with sort of some people like Matt Brunig who believes that. But essentially that would be everybody owns kind of a share of society, and then you collectively vote over what the kind of large decision maker does in that giant corporation. And that's, I guess, the kind of division versus the other vision, which is actually everybody needs to have a little piece of land instead of everybody working on a collective giant farm.
Okay, so now we get up to the New Deal. Brandeis's vision wins the day to some extent. I mean, obviously, you know, investment in a lot of the New Deal also involved investing in public works.
That's not a communist framework. I mean, there have been, you know, investment in public works has been something that, you know, that's 500 years old, 1,000
right.
years old. That's not the idea that the government creates roads, or that the government creates, you know, infrastructure, that it has collective obligations, is not that's not something that, like, is a, you know, yes, there's some centralization involved there, but it's, you know, we had the post office in 1792. This is not a, part of that. That doesn't belong to this, they say, the Marxist tradition.
Right. But yet, I mean, theoretically, one could imagine a situation where it's like, we don't want to give the federal government. And I guess maybe there's competition in terms of, you know, municipal governments and state governments all have a different role in terms of dealing with roads, let's say. And maybe there's, the gist of the New Deal was not just a function of antitrust. That was just a big part of how to deal with the problems that had come out of the Depression.
Well, so it's not just the antitrust. Antitrust is a specific type of law that's fairly narrow to deal with industrial companies.
Anti-monopolization.
But, you know what? Part of it was anti-monopolization, but in the anti-monopoly tradition is much bigger than just antitrust, right? So antitrust goes after specific industrial companies. What happened in the 1920s is you saw this decade of corporatism where people lost faith in democracy. And I go into Andrew Mellon, who's this like fascinating evil character, or he's sort of a villain. He's Secretary of the Treasury, like does all sorts of self-dealing. It's like it's a very corrupt and fascinating decade. The KKK is ascendant. Everybody's demoralized. Who cares about democracy? And then in the 1930s, the people who are essentially governing in that era are large financial holding companies, namely the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Mellons, and J.P. Morgan, the bank, right? Those guys are these are financial, effectively informal financial empires, and they control most of the business and political assets of the United States. Now, the New Deal was about attacking and destroying the power that those four families had over the American political economy. And he did that through a whole set of different policy choices and protests, including fiscal policy, so like breaking the control that the bankers had over the Federal Reserve. Yes, there was the antitrust, labor policy, like so unionization, social welfare, and then financial policy, but also things like breaking up the electric utilities, which we also did, or breaking up aerospace companies, which we also did, or breaking up banks, which we also did. And then there was a whole bunch of fights over, you know, and this took years. This took, you know, 5 to 10 years. It was like, imagine everything that Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders is proposing, and like 75% of that stuff gets done and then in 5 to 10 years. I mean, that's what the New Deal was actually about. And it was basically the only experiment that showed that democracy could work in the 1930s. Other than that, you had a bunch of weak democracies that were kind of flailing around and people were very unhappy, France and England. And then you had you had fascism, which for a lot of people seemed to kind of deliver what the democracies could not. And then you had the Soviet Union, which again, I mean, this was all PR, but at the time people were like, oh, they're actually seem to be delivering, kind of lifting people out of poverty. It's very much the way that like people often look at China today. They have something that's kind of working. And so the New Deal was so important because it did show that you could have a government that was governed by its people, that we did not have to knuckle under to these private financial autocrats who were running things. And so, you know, today you see Mark Zuckerberg, right? He's kind of testifying before Congress as a business leader, but really not as a business leader, more as a political leader who's making choices about what we as a society get to see, right? And that's the level of – and the real debate today is between Elizabeth Warren and Mark Zuckerberg. It's not between any of the candidates. That's the level of political fight that we're dealing with today, and that's the level of political fight that we were dealing with from the 19-teens until the 1930s. It was a fight over who governs, the people through their democratic institutions or autocrats through financial holding companies and industrial monopolies.
And okay, so let's go into just tell us about Wright Patman, and we will you know sort of I guess work our way through most of the 20th century till we get to the 70s where this sort of falls apart. But tell us who Wright Patman was.
Yeah, so Wright Patman is this cotton tenant farmer from Texarkana, which is sort of the border of Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and he gets elected to Congress in 1928, takes office in 1929, and he starts attacking Andrew Mellon and supporting, trying to get World War One veterans money that they were that they hadn't been paid during the war. He was like, they should be paid. Basically, their pension should be accelerated. And this is not a big fight until the Depression, when everything kind of collapses. And the veterans themselves start marching to D.C., very much like Occupy Wall Street. And they say, hey, we're poor. We fought for this country. You should, you know, help us. The government should help us. And out of that, Patman ended up filing articles of impeachment against Andrew Mellon, who was blocking the payment to these veterans. And then Herbert Hoover tear gassed them. And that was, you know, and got rid of, you know, pushed them out of D.C. And it was the army. He ordered the army to do it. The army was led by Douglas MacArthur, Dwight D. Eisenhower, like sort of later heroes. And that was kind of the laid the foundation. This was called the Bonus March. That laid the foundation for the New Deal, because it showed how corrupt and callous the old order was. And then I go into how FDR ended up outmaneuvering the monopolists in the Democratic Party in the 1932 primary, who wanted to run on social issues and not the economy. And then he ended up defeating Hoover and had this kind of gang fight between, you know, he put Mellon on trial for tax fraud. You know, this is the Secretary of the Treasury and the third richest guy in the country, and he goes on trial for tax fraud. You know, he breaks their power kind of systematically. And it's this, not just FDR, but these you know, Wright Patman is hugely involved in this, fighting against corruption, both in the corporate state, in the banking world, also in the judiciary. There are massive fights within the judiciary. And Patman is also fights against chain stores. So they had their Walmarts in the 1920s and 30s. It was called the A&P, which today we know of as a sort of a harmless store that went bankrupt a couple of years ago. But in the 1920s and 30s, it was the predatory Walmart of its day. And Patman led the fight to impose pricing laws to prevent them from driving their competitors out of business. And so over the course of the late 1920s, all the way into the 1970s, because Patman lasted, you know, he lived until 1976, and he eventually became the chair of the banking committee in the 60s.
48 years in Congress.
46 years. 46 years. And then I think 15 years or 14 years as the head of the banking committee. He fought against concentrations of power. He fought against banking deregulation. And you know, in some cases, he fought against his own party to impose that. And he was he lost a lot of battles, but he also won a lot of battles. And then in 1976, and this is for kind of a lot of different reasons, but mainly it was that a new generation of Democrats came into office in 1974. It was a reaction to Watergate. Now, ironically, Patman, as the head of the banking committee, had actually been the first Democrat to investigate Watergate in 1972 before the election. And he fought with Nixon, and ultimately his own party refused to allow him to get a subpoena into the Nixon White House. And so this new generation gets elected in 74. But this generation, and this is Bill Clinton's generation, they don't care about what Democrats have traditionally cared about, which is banking power and corporate power and monopolies. Instead, they're thinking about the Pentagon, right? They're thinking about environmentalism. They're thinking about a whole bunch of kind of a different vision of social justice that was created in the 1950s that airbrushed all of the fights that we used to have about corporate power out of our collective memory. And this is the Watergate baby generation. And then behind the scenes, one of the first things that happened is the bankers manipulated them into voting Patman out of his committee assignment chairing the banking committee. And so they got the bankers managed to finally, in the end, get rid of Wright Patman. And then later, a few months later, he died. But that was the moment, 1975, when they got rid of Patman, in which the Democratic Party adopted a new philosophy of cooperating with concentrated capital. And that same Congress, they got rid of the laws that were protecting the American independent retailer and manufacturer from chain stores. And so in 1970, Walmart has $30 million, $40 million of revenue. By 1980, it has $1 billion of revenue. And this is because in 1975, Congress, this Democratic Congress, this Watergate baby Congress, gets rid of some of the pricing rules that have constrained chain stores. And then they start doing deregulation. And this is the Democrats who are doing it because they believe in it, right? And Ralph Nader is actually pushing deregulation.
All right, hold on one second. So I want to get into Ralph Nader, but I just want to plant a flag here and just say, I think in the past, I think we've talked to you about this, about the Atari Democrats. We've done a couple of interviews with Lily Geitzmer. This era, there was a lot of things going on within the Democratic Party. This was almost one feature of it, but it was all sort of emanating around this, a similar push, right? Where the Democrats abandoned labor. Maybe that's or I should say unions in particular on some level to make ostensibly the primary purpose, the primaries more democratic in some ways. And we also see the sort of the adoption of what you call social justice or maybe emancipation movements or environmentalism, other issues become to the fore. How much, though, we should say at this point, like when Patman is jettisoned, we should also say that he was part of his coalition was built on a certain amount of racism. Yes, I mean, is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, that's true. So, yes, that's right. He had votes. So Patman has an interesting relationship with race. This is very complicated. But in the 1920s, he fought against the Klan, right? In rural Texas, he was the deep, you know, very opposed to the Klan.
And we should say this is when the Klan was basically, I think there was 6 million card carrying members in 1920 out of a population of 100 million. That's a lot of people to be proud Klan members, right? I mean, you know, who knows if there was any ashamed ones, but that's a lot. That's a huge portion of the population.
Yeah, the mayor of Portland, Oregon, and Portland, Maine, were both Klan in 1922. I mean, it was a mainstream movement that was based on, you know, it's fascinating. But Patman was opposed to the Klan, and Patman also did a bunch of things that were he made sure that economic power. He tried to distribute economic power regardless of race. He got the first black member of the board of governors of the Federal Reserve on the board in the 1960s. He passed the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which is an anti-discrimination statute in, I guess, 69 or 70, actually going around his own committee. But he also voted for segregation in the early 50s and was a signer of the Southern Manifesto. And he said very explicitly in the 70s why he did that, which is, I would have lost my seat in rural Texas if I hadn't. And he was also, there were always primary candidates that the far right wing was putting up against him, saying he was insufficiently dedicated to the cause of segregation. But what happened by 1975 is not that there was nobody in 75 really pushed Patman out because of race. So that wasn't the issue. And he had defenders in Congress who were black, and he had people in Congress who were black who opposed him. You know, the issue was just, and I talked to a bunch of the Watergate baby members. They were just like, oh, he was too old. And the neoliberal generation that emerged in 1975, it's not that they were like, oh, race is actually what matters, versus the older generation who were saying, oh no, actually race doesn't matter. It's all about economic power. That's not what the debate was. The debate were two different visions of racial justice. And one of the visions of racial justice, which was also about economic justice, was we need to have a democracy and undo the institutional concentrations of power that enable discrimination of both against African Americans and women and the small shopkeeper. And the other, and this was the neoliberal framework, was basically we need to have we need to allow discrimination against the small shopkeeper and against the little guy. But we need to make sure that, in this kind of greed is good paradigm, that nobody exploits gender or racial identity to advantage themselves. They can do other things. They can exploit fraud. They can exploit corruption. But that is a no-no. So now both of these visions of a kind of multicultural oligarchy and a multicultural democracy have embedded in them a vision of social justice and a vision of racial justice. But they are different. I wouldn't say that the Patman vision, which really comes back from Brandeis, you know, you could go back and, you know, Frederick Douglass hated monopolies. And there's a whole, you know, sort of interesting racial dynamic here. That one, it's not, I don't think it's as simple as saying, oh, Patman was racist and this new generation wasn't. I think you know, anyway, so that's just a,
well, but I mean, put aside
a different vision.
Right. But I mean, put aside, whatever Patman's actual feelings were, right? I mean, clearly he was constrained by a racist constituency. And I guess really in terms of, because ultimately what you're writing about is power, right? And at the end of the day, like I say, you know, what was in his heart, or even what, you know, what was really relevant is the, like, to what extent he could push the limits of his constituency's patience, and to what extent.
Well, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the laws that we don't think of as anti-discrimination measures, like anti-chain store laws or laws that prevent, you know, monopolization, that those are actually also very important civil rights laws that we just don't think of as such. And those are the laws that Patman was protecting and that Brandeis was protecting, and that, you know, those are the first laws that Bork attacked, and those are the laws that the Watergate baby generation got rid of. So that's what I'm saying. It's not that like Patman couldn't. Yeah, I mean, he voted for segregation. There's no getting around that. And it was, you know, that's an immoral thing to do. What I'm saying is that the neoliberal generation, the deal that was cut in 1975 and 76, was a deal to entrench a different form and much more pernicious form of racism than the one that came out of the New Deal. That's all this is about. You destroy black banks. You destroy black stores. You know, you destroy black economic power. That is a form of racism that is extremely vicious. It just happens through monopolization and predatory pricing. And we don't sort of see it as kind of a civil rights problem, but we should. And that is an ideological flaw in the way that the civil rights movement has kind of thought about the world since the 1975 or so. I mean, neoliberalism is everywhere. It is in the civil rights movement today. It is in the way that we think about race today. And that's a problem, right?
Right. And I guess that's where I'm trying to get at, is just sort of examine, like, the difficulty, it seems to be, is that the and stipulating that I think you're right, like, the sort of the material implications in terms of how it impacts a race of neoliberal policies in many ways are more dramatic than you know, long term, at least in terms of, like, accruing power for these communities
let me put it in a more stark way. Obama's a black president, right? He oversaw the largest theft of black wealth in our lifetimes, and maybe in 80 years. Okay, we have no way to talk about that because the neoliberal framework of race is designed to obscure power, and it's a racist framework. It's not as bad as Jim Crow, but it was a reactionary turn in 1975 and 1976, so that we cannot honestly talk about race. Nobody can honestly talk about race because that is what happened. That's what happened in 2008 to 2014. And I brought this up over and over and over, and Democrats cannot come to grips with it. They can't handle it because they are enthralled to the neoliberal framework on power and money and business and race and everything else. And I wrote this book to explain what happened, to explain why we're in this framework. But I don't accept – the framing of the way that we talk about race is fundamentally dishonest today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you and I had that conversation, I think, in the lead up to the 2012 election, actually. But I'm not disagreeing with that assessment, I'm also suggesting that there's another half of that story, which is that it doesn't strike me as a coincidence that Patman came from a background that, you know, and I'm not talking about him personally, but his constituency was also happened to be racist, and you know, you and I may or may not agree or disagree, I don't know, on the implications of their racism as terms of how it materially impacts, you know, black people, let's say. And I'm not even sure that, you know, you and I can assess like what's the most important thing there. And it's not really relevant to the point I'm making.
The 1920s were a fascist era. I mean, let's just call Jim Crow what it was in the South. It was fascism. Like that's it was sustained terrorist violence against black people. It was not as bad against poor white people, but it did disenfranchise poor white people. And it particularly singled out black people with economic power. Those were the people who were often the targets of lynchings. Those were the people. That's why they burned down, you know, Black Wall Street in Tulsa. This was Jim Crow was a system that was designed to keep black people in servitude by attacking the foundations of their economic power. Now, Patman broke from that somewhat because he was trying to deal with breaking the hold that concentrated Northern capital, which was an important part of Jim Crow, by the way. He was trying to say, you know, we're going to break from that. And then the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s built on top of the New Deal and said, no, we're actually, now that we've kind of shown that there can be an imperfect democracy, we're going to try to let all people, black and white and women and gay, we're going to try to let them all into this democracy. The whole point is that in 1975, the Watergate babies, and then they got corrupted in the 1980s, but the Watergate babies decided that democracy did not incorporate economic power. Right. And that is a deeply, deeply reactionary thing to do. And you can go back and say, oh, you know, Patman's constituents were racist. Absolutely. And you can go back to, you know, the 1870s and discover kind of why that racism was created, why that was engendered.
Right.
And that was a propaganda campaign after the Civil War, put forward, actually after the financial crisis of 1873, it was put forward by Northern capital. So the fight here is complicated. And always has to do with political and economic power, and it manifests itself through racial terrorism. But to just kind of like the way that we talk about the problem today airbrushes out all of those questions of power so that we can get to this libertarian framework of saying, and I'm not saying you're saying this, I'm saying that this is kind of the way that I hear the racial discussion today. It's always just what is in your heart as an individual, right? Do you believe in equality as an individual or not? And it's like that doesn't matter. What matters is whether equality is embedded in our institutions of power, because there are always going to be jerks. There are always going to be people that want to bully others. The question in a democracy is whether you can make sure that everybody has equal rights and that no one can use power to bully other people. That's kind of where we have to go. And that is the populist, more democratic approach to addressing the problem of discrimination against the powerful versus the powerless.
All right, and just to be clear, like I agree with that perspective. All I'm suggesting two things. One is that I think there has to be some sensitivity to the lived experience of people who are subjected to racism. On an individual level, I think that's an important thing to say, but I'm also suggesting that there's a relationship between the, largely poor white, constituency and their relationship, to racism, that allowed a guy like Patman to function in the way that he was functioning. And I'm just saying that that's the other half of that. You know, there are the forces that took Patman out, but there were also the forces that maintained him. And I'm just suggesting that that is also, you know, like an important part of the story. But
so it's an interesting question. Patman Patman's political power actually came through rural postmasters. So before, you know, he had the postmasters essentially delivering his direct mail and talking to people. And his, you know, the reason people voted for him is because he delivered roads and farm supports and Social Security and rural electrification That's why he had a whole bunch of people. I mean, if his constituents were just into white supremacy, they wouldn't have picked Patton because there were often people running against him who were more white supremacist than he was. It was just about delivering the things that they wanted and needed on a material basis. And then when, you know, the Civil Rights Act passed and there was black people in his district got the right to vote, they tended to vote for Patton. So his political support came from the things that Democrats in 1975, when they transitioned to this kind of concentrated capital TV friendly politics, they started losing that immediately. And his supporters, a lot of his supporters were in credit unions and pharmacists and small business people. Right. And those people supported Patton and they supported the Democrats largely because the FTC protected small business from chain stores and protected small business from monopolists. And almost immediately in the late 1970s, when Jimmy Carter, you know, under the influence of Ralph Nader, turned the FTC against small business under the grounds that they needed to protect consumers. And it didn't matter whether it were big or small businesses, we just have to go after and protect consumers and not care about business at all. Almost immediately, the FTC was pushed back aggressively. They lost their constituency base. And then when Reagan came into office in 1981, he effectively just turned out the lights at the FTC and nobody cared because the small business constituency had lost faith in the FTC and the Democratic Party to do anything. So the loss of that anti-monopoly sentiment, that battle against concentrated power, had really significant impacts. And then when Walmart came in and just chewed up the entire small business constituency in the South and in the Rust Belt, all of those civic leaders who had been the civic leadership for the Democratic Party disappeared, right? And that's the creation of Red and Blue America right there.
All right. And let's get explicit about the sort of three projects that came together, because one of them was that consumer movement. And I think that's a little bit counterintuitive for people to sort of see like the consumer movement being one of the pillars of what has happened with our anti-monopolism in this country, financialization, and then the Chicago School, which is, you know, all three are related. But just walk us through those three projects.
Yeah, so the Chicago School, the Law and Economics Movement, I have a chapter in my book about this. They were created in the late 1940s, early 50s, and they this was a kind of reconstruction of robber baron capitalism. And so it was a very cynical guy named Aaron Director, who trained Milton Friedman, George Stigler, Robert Bork, and he was actually the brother-in-law of Milton Friedman, and he grew up in Portland, Oregon in the 20s. He's Jewish, Russian immigrant. And so he was very cynical about democracy because the people around him were, you know, anti-Semitic and in the KKK. And so he took this a very elitist attitude. First, he became a socialist, and then eventually he went to the University of Chicago and was funded by this right-wing lunatic named Harold Lunau, and he created neoliberalism. He broke conservatism away from anti-monopoly thinking. A lot of conservatives had hated the government and labor, but they also hated monopolies. Aaron Director is the guy who said, no, we're going to hate government, we're going to hate labor, but we're going to support monopolies and support concentrated capital. And he built a whole intellectual project that centered the University of Chicago to create the tools, the legal tools to unleash concentrated capital and to undo the New Deal. But he wouldn't have been successful unless the second trend, financialization, had not occurred. And this was done by a guy named Walter Wriston at National City or Citibank. So Walter Wriston, again, same thing, got his start in the late 40s, early 50s at National City. The banking system was really heavily controlled. And he's the most important banker since J.P. Morgan. And he's the guy who really led early deregulation, had bitter fights with Wright Patman in the 1960s over undoing the New Deal financial controls, particularly around where banks could get deposits. And when he undid those New Deal controls in 1961 with something called the negotiable certificate of deposit, all of a sudden you saw massive increases in capitalization in the stock market. You saw what was called the go-go years and conglomerates, which were an early prelude to mutual funds, an early prelude to the 1980s and financial power. And that started slamming into the real economy in the late 1960s, and particularly in 1970, when the train system, Penn Central, much of the train system in the Northeast went bankrupt. It was the largest bankruptcy in American history. It was sort of the Enron of its day. And that's what actually led to the conservatives deciding, business elite deciding to organize politically. So that's why they wrote the Powell memo. That's why they did a bunch of the kind of things that we just think, oh, they got greedy in the early 70s. It's like, no, what happened is the financial system was in crisis. Corporate America was in crisis. And they started to have a political debate about what to do. And it was because financialization had slammed into the real economy, had bankrupted the train system. And it's because of the forces that Walter Wriston had let loose. Pavin had been fighting him, but he wasn't able to totally stop it, although he did stop a bailout of Penn Central. And then the third force is the consumer rights movement. And this is really John Kenneth Galbraith and Richard Hofstadter, again, late 1940s, early 50s. All of this is in the specter of the McCarthy reactionary movement. Some of the funders of McCarthy Red Scare were also behind the law and economics movement. So these guys were corporate liberals, and they rewrote the history. They were very important. So Galbraith and Hofstadter rewrote our history, and they got rid of the idea that fights happened in the late 19th century around the money trust and corporate power. They said, that's all fake. In fact, what was happening is these farmers who were fighting the bankers and railroads, they weren't really fighting them. They were actually just Anglo-Saxons who were afraid of losing their WASP privilege. It was a fight over what was called status anxiety. And then with that new framework, Galbraith developed this something called affluence, which was this notion that America was just this endlessly affluent society, and we didn't need to fight over corporate power anymore. We had figured that out. There was no inequality, or inequality was not important. Monopolies were progressive, all this stuff that he kind of framed. And he taught the entire counterculture, because he was very opposed to the war in Vietnam, and in many ways was heroic, but his ideas were catastrophic. And the counterculture in the 1960s and learned from Galbraith and Hofstadter and C. Wright Mills and a whole bunch of people who hated small business and didn't want to have debates over corporate power, or they were just socialists, they learned to not care about monopolies. And then in the 1970s, they became this consumer rights movement led by Ralph Nader, who said, it was very similar to what consumer rights people said in the 19-teens and 20s, that production doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is consumers. And so chain stores can be good. And the only thing that matters is sort of price and safety and quality. Workers didn't matter. Unions don't matter. Big business, big unions, both corrupt. Big government, corrupt. The only thing that matters is consumerism. And then they got fooled. In the 1970s, you have this crisis in corporate America caused by financialization. And then you have the law and economics movement. And you have the last of the populists like Phil Hart, Hubert Humphrey, and Wright Patman saying, save the shopkeeper, break up big business. And then you have this consumer rights movement that's sitting in the middle. And they end up mostly aligning with the law and economics guys and pushing for deregulation and pushing for financialization. And they didn't know what they were doing. Nader didn't know what he was doing. But he does things like he creates the corporate right to free speech. He pushes for banking deregulation and airline deregulation and trucking deregulation. And that's why the Carter administration is a catastrophe. And then Reagan gets into office. By the time Reagan gets into office, there is no more debate, right? The left, Patton's died, Phil Hart's died, Humphrey's died, and there's no one to carry the torch. And so this new generation of Watergate babies is in charge, and they basically agree with Reagan that corporate concentration is inevitable, is progressive, is natural, is scientific.
And just to explain to people like why they felt that way, and this is how we got the sort of the Borkian version of antitrust, is that this concentration leads to cheaper products. Maybe, you know, theoretically, maybe like, you know, we can get it overnight delivered to us now. I mean, it's all based upon a looking at the world through the lens exclusively of how much stuff can I consume and in its most convenient way.
That's right. And our legal framework was structured so that we stopped caring about competitive process and concentrations of power, essentially a big is bad skepticism, and move towards, as you put it, consumer price. And so something like Google or Facebook, they both offer free. They're free. They're, you don't have to pay for them with money. Obviously, you pay with other things. But it's very hard for the way that we interpret antitrust laws today to see the concentration of power in the hands of Google or Facebook or Amazon. It's not impossible. It's just that you know, there are other things going on.
These are externalities, right? I mean, this is sort of a classic case of some externalities insofar as that we don't realize where we're paying for these free services or these reduced price services in the because it's not doesn't show up necessarily as dollars as much as it does. I mean, ultimately it might, but it shows up in the context of political power and sort of, I guess, things that are a little bit less tangible in the context of society.
Well, it's just that we as consumers aren't the ones paying the price. The people that are paying the price are the publishers and the sellers through Amazon, right? So traditionally you would have like a seller going through an Amazon or a sell, like the Standard Oil fight was between Wildcatters and Standard Oil as the distributor of the oil. It wasn't necessarily about consumer prices, although there was some of that. And so it's like if you're looking at Walmart or you're looking at Amazon or you're looking at Google, you don't look on the consumer side for the problem. You look on the producer side. It's the workers, it's the suppliers, it's the manufacturers getting screwed. So if we wanted to apply the law like we used to, it would be easy to find the harm. It's just that the harm is not necessarily when you log into your Facebook account. It's the death. It's the fact that Facebook is appropriating the revenue, the advertising revenue that used to go to the New York Times. Facebook is now getting it because they're able to take the data effectively from every publisher on the internet. They're able to coercively take that data and then outcompete them because data is really important in terms of selling advertising. So it's like, it's not hard to figure out how to use the law to attack the concentration of power. It's just that if you're seeing things from the consumer standpoint, instead of from a citizen standpoint or a producer standpoint, right, then you don't see the power.
Right. That's my point, is that these externalities are in a different currency, if you will, or just a different silo of our existence, which has been largely devalued. I mean, I think at least in the popular culture. I mean, I've heard you, you know, talk about the, you know, just the implications of the blogs when Google basically came in and bigfooted everybody and dried up all the advertising revenue, and the implications of that, just in terms of like the different voices we hear.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's we are increasingly living in an autocracy in the commercial side of our lives, right? So we get bossed around, you know, whether you're a chicken farmer, you're an Uber driver, or you're an engineer at Boeing, like you increasingly have less and less agency. You might have a nicer servitude depending on where you are. But it's not a surprise that as people get used to being bossed around in the commercial sector, in the trade that they do, that they increasingly get used to being bossed around in the political sector. And that's why you see rising autocracy. That's what Trump is, but that's also what you see all over the world. Monopolization is a form of autocracy. It's a private government. That's what's going on. We are having these mini private governments linked together by Wall Street, organizing our society.
So how do, well, I mean, I still have a lot I wanted to get to, but and I guess the question is sort of, how do you what's the best way to tackle this? But how do you get people to care? You know, I mean, like, I you know, like, I mean, how do you say
they do care?
What's that?
They do care. In Goliath, I go into this. It's they do care. I think people just don't have the language to understand that, like, what to do. And they don't have the language to think of themselves as citizens. So in Goliath, you know, I talk about the preface is about how we just didn't know that this was our heritage, right? And I wrote this book so that people would understand that the history of America in the 20th century, which is really the history that's like the America was kind of the central area of debate in the world at that for most of the 20th century, that history is about the heritage. That's our heritage, and the suspicion that we feel towards concentrated power, which we all feel, is very American, right? The idea that we want fair markets, that we want to get rid of the financier manipulating us, as a political matter, that is deeply embedded in the American experiment. And we have to know that in order to reclaim our liberties as a free people.
I mean, but what if somebody says, like, you know, all that sounds great, but I like, you know, I like just being able to go on my computer and I want a pair of sneakers and it comes here in 2 days.
Well, look, I mean, ultimately we're going to have to make the argument for freedom, right? I mean, that's just the reality. It's like, if somebody really wants 2-day shipping and they're willing to give up their liberty for 2-day shipping, then, and that's the thing that they care about most in the world, we're going to lose that. Right. We're going to lose. We lose our freedom. We lose our democracy. But the reality is, you can have 2-day shipping without losing your democracy. Like, none of these, you can have flight without having American Airlines charge you baggage fees. There's nothing inherent about the technology that commands a certain political regulatory schema. However, ultimately, this is a question of values, and it is a question of whether we want to be a free people or whether we don't. And that's the debate that we're having. That's the debate that Bernie, that Warren, that Trump, that Buttigieg, that they're all articulating their position on that question. And some people are saying, yeah, you know what, I am willing to sell my heritage, as Brandeis put it, for a mess of pottage, right? He, as a consumer, you're willing to do anything for that 2-day shipping. And there are others who are saying, no, I want to live in a society where I am not in servitude to others.
And I add there, I mean, there's also, you know, there are broader implications in terms of what we're doing. We pay that price in other political decisions and arguably things like wage stagnation and et cetera, when we are, you know, signing up for that type of monopoly. All right. So lastly.
Right. I mean, it's not like we're living in an economic paradise.
Right.
Like this, it's like the whole framework is ridiculous. But like, even accepting that.
All right. So lastly, Warren and Bernie, what, from your perspective, because I think there are, you know, folks in these parts who would argue that it's not the difference between them is not of a matter of degree, but rather of a kind. What's your perspective on that?
I don't think they have really, I don't think there's really much difference ideologically. I think they're different. They have different political priorities, different political styles. But, you know, Bernie used to carry around Wright Patman reports when he would walk around Vermont in the 70s from the banking committee talking about chain banking. Elizabeth Warren, you know, she knows Patman. She very much is like, comes out of that Patman style opposition to concentrated power, the hearings, the rigor, the anti-monopolism. It's both. You know, both of them effectively want to distribute a little bit of property to everybody. They both kind of have a Brandeisian frame. They both are essentially New Deal Democrats. It's the same tradition. They obviously have a different, like, kind of different styles, maybe different approaches to gaining political power. A lot of the, like, attempts to explain, you know, to explain one of them as kind of inherently more, you know, better or whatever, it's just like, it's kind of annoying. Warren is a much stronger bureaucratic leader. She will ride a bureaucracy to do things. Bernie is much more, he's a more capable communicator to the broad public. I don't think that you can say that one of them is kind of better. They are different. I am not convinced that either one of them is perfect. I think there are problems with both. I think there are benefits to both, but by and large, the disagreement over Bernie and Warren comes from the basic fact that Obama was a terrible president, and neither side can admit it. And so when Warren, a lot of Warren's accomplishments are in preventing Obama from doing the horrible things that he really wanted to do, and she can't brag about that because Democrats love Obama, and she has to get their votes. And I think what Bernie was really doing in 2016 was running against the shitty legacy of Obama, but he can't brag about that because Democrats like Obama. So that's really the subtext for all of this. And I think there are legitimate grounds for criticism of both of them, but I just don't think that philosophically they really disagree.
And you don't think there is a the relevance of some programs being means tested versus universality that doesn't as a political tactic or mechanism in which to sort of you know, raise an awareness of people's role beyond a consumer? None of that moves you?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you could just as easily say, you know, Warren says she wants to break up big tech and Bernie just doesn't. Bernie wants to say, oh, we need an antitrust attorney general who will enforce the antitrust laws, which is a, you know, that's a subtle way of not calling for breaking up big tech. But I don't think that, like, Bernie is not going to be aggressive on, you know, on dealing with big tech. I think that, like, Warren certainly has a more aggressive plan, but I'm not going to, like, I mean, I think we all know where Bernie is coming from in the same way I think we all know where Warren is coming from, or at least, you know, so the parsing those kind of small distinctions on kind of these plans is it's sort of silly. And I mean, I think you could definitely make the argument that, like, Bernie and his plans on social welfare have been a little bit more left wing, and, you know, Warren on her plan on, you know, ag and tech have been more populist and more opposed to concentrated power. And I think those are fine debates to have. I think there's legitimate grounds for criticizing the CFPB for, you know, not being particularly effective. I think there's legitimate grounds for criticizing Bernie for not really doing much on the foreclosure crisis. I think there's legitimate grounds for going after, you know, for putting sort of both of them through the ringer, and we should do that. But the basic problem is Democrats have been terrible, and Democrats, particularly Obama, was terrible. And we have to reckon with that. And both Warren and Bernie can't fully reckon with it, because the Democratic base, including the left, by the way, and we had that debate in 2012. And I remember, you know, like, I was the only one out there saying this guy's no good. Right. And I'm still pretty much one of the only people saying he did a bad job, and we have to reckon with that. Like, that's the fundamental problem here. And that's why, like, this kind of shadow boxing over Warren and Bernie is kind of besides the point.
Fair enough. And people can go back and listen to that conversation that we had. I must have been pre-2012, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I think you've been on a couple of times since then. But and to be fair, we also did have, there was I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but from the Black Agenda report, it was Glenn Ford, actually, I think we had on. Making a similar argument, maybe not necessarily the exact same terms that you were arguing at that time.
I was arguing for voting for third party in 2012, or not voting for Obama, even in swing states. And, like, the guy who was opposed to us was Mitt Romney. I remember at the time people were like, oh my gosh, he's the worst. I can't believe Mitt Romney. You know, how dare you? And it's like, today Mitt Romney is like a hero of the resistance. Like, it was embarrassing. It's embarrassing. People should be embarrassed about their political judgment. It was really bad.
Well, I mean, if it makes any difference, I am not a fan of Mitt Romney's today.
Well, no, that's fair.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a fan of Obama or
right,
Mitt Romney.
Right.
I mean, like, like,
all right.
It's a relative question.
Well, nevertheless, Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. Matt Stoller, really appreciate you coming on today, and think the book is fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. All right, and we will put a link, folks, to Goliath on the in the podcast description and on the blog. And check it out. It's really important history to understand, and you will enjoy it. It's actually a fun thing to read in tandem with We Got People. Some of the histories bump up against each other a little bit. Fun read, as we say, around the Cedar House. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. We went a little long today. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. We can't do it without you. And if so, you're one of those people who listen to the show on a regular basis, want to support the program, join themajorityreport.com. When you do, not only do you get this show commercial free, but you also get extra content every day. And you get the self-satisfaction of knowing that you are a supporter of the Majority Report. And that that feels so good. And apparently I've been remiss in mentioning this. And again, you got to have patience for us. But if you want the fun half, but do not have the financial resources, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and maybe put in the subject line, want the fun half. Send us an email. We don't turn anybody away for financial reasons. If you got a bad attitude, or maybe you and I had a run-in somewhere and we had some type of problem, yeah, we'll turn you away. But if but we don't do it for financial reasons. If I don't like your writing style, that's majorityreporters@gmail.com. Don't forget to sign up for the AM Quickie. And today is Monday. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Michael, what will be happening on your show?
Crystal Ball will be joining us. Harvey Kay will be joining us.
We're going to have Harvey Kay. He's going to spend the whole double header.
Harvey Kay is going to be here all day. And I believe, and no doubt he would be ready to do a third show after both of those. A very energetic gentleman. We're going to be talking about the global, I mean, really global anti-austerity uprisings from Lebanon to Chile to Haiti. And why do they get so little press coverage here? Does it fit into the Chomsky model? And a whole bunch of other things. Also, an interview.
Feels different from the Hong Kong. The spring.
The Arab Spring. Very different. And I mean, and the Arab Spring had a bigger economic component than was acknowledged at the time, too. But very excited to get into that. Plus, you know, some of the election results out of Argentina and Uruguay. A whole bunch of other things. And also, a little bit off format, just did an interview with Kashama Sawant, which will be playing on tomorrow's show. Her election in 2013, I believe it was, to the Seattle City Council was one of these moments that we talk about, you know, the Chicago teacher strikes, Black Lives Matter, the Sanders campaign. And she's running for her third term, and Amazon alone has dumped $1 million into beating her. So, and actually, I'll just say now, you can vote now in Seattle. The election is on November 5th, but they have a mail-in voting system. So this is definitely the time to, pull rank for her. And also, I guess, actually some progressive Democrats as well who are also being a target in Seattle. So that was a really important conversation. Tomorrow, 7 o'clock, there's a pre-stream at 6 as well. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, and snag your tickets to Philly. They're over 2/3 sold out with 4 weeks to go.
Jamie is not here, but you can check out The Antifada at patreon.com/TheAntifada. Matt?
My Salem Witch Trials episode for Literary Hangover is finally up, where we talk about, among other things, how it represented the final gasp of the theocratic Puritan agricultural community versus the mercantile capitalists. So, for instance, before 1665, 2-to-1, farmers outnumbered merchants on their sort of selectmen, their governing body. And then between 1665 to 1700, merchants would outnumber them 6-to-1. And actually, the agricultural people got their revenge by hanging 19 people and throwing hundreds in prison. So.
There you go. So people talk about the rancor in our politics today. Oh, this is exciting for me because Mile and I just got our red string that we're now using for Hunt a Killer. And Hunt a Killer is the murder mystery subscription box that immerses you in an ongoing detective experience. Does not include red string, but you can get it anywhere. With every delivery, you sift through elaborate case files and evidence, eliminating suspects until you crack the case and catch the killer. Right now, we're doing one. There was a problem with a class reunion. So, and right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. Hurry to take advantage of this offer. Embrace your inner detective. Folks, this is super fun. I don't know if people do it with their kids, but I'm doing it with my daughter, and it's the only time that we actually talk to each other now. huntakiller.com/majority, 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. We, of course, will put a link in the podcast and YouTube description. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. back, back, back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ the Anarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
What? What? What? What?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
There doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Blasphemy around here. I am a total pussy,
total,
pussy,
total,
pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, puss